Blog Talk Radio.
We are the UR Tennis Network. Our mission is to be the voice of tennis. We enlist a team of passionate enthusiasts to promote our sport. We strive to bring interesting perspectives on the many spins of tennis. Our goal is to provide the learners of our sport with current news and information from many angles. We seek active participation from communities interested in tennis, but tennis is not interested in them. We are expanding our outreach. Tennis is a true lifetime sport that needs to be talked about, and the UR Tennis Network pledges to pursue this idea relentlessly.
Hello, hello, and welcome to Infinite Tennis. I'm your host, Bill Patton. What is Infinite Tennis? Infinite Tennis is the guy that learns to draw very well, makes pretty pictures of tennis players, illustrating his own book, Observing Best Practices of Elite Players. Infinite Tennis is the unlimited range of possibilities by which people bring unique talents to bear on life's rich tennis pageant. Infinite Tennis strives to bring you everything that makes sense and nothing that doesn't. If you want to reach me, contact me on Twitter at School of Tennis with questions for guests and all that. Also, I'm available in the 510 and the 925 for lessons and clinics. I'm setting up some small group training for elite juniors, so I hope that you will get in touch with me for some high-intensity training. You can always shoot me an email at schooloftennis@gmail.com. All right, it's time for Play Better today, and we're going to talk about the factors that you can monitor and manage in momentum. And I dare not say control. These are not necessarily things you can control, but you can monitor and manage. Understand that the vast majority of matches are won simply by the person who wins more points than the other. The exceptions to that rule are when one player either capitalizes on a total number of break chances greater than the other, or one player recovers from having played a horrible set in order to win. Which momentum factors are in your control that you can monitor and manage? One, your effort level. Two, your attitude about the competition. Three, your body language and comportment in the match. Four, your ability to adjust your tactics to the relative strengths and weaknesses of your opponent on the day, in a set, in a point. First, if you are able to keep your effort level at relatively close to 100%, then when your opponent's effort level dips, then that's when you will have an opportunity to gain positive momentum. Second, when an opponent or conditions are difficult or distracting, having the best possible attitude can protect you from making excuses, which can be an entree into lower performance and thus a momentum loser. If opponents are visually distracting for whatever reason, avoid looking at them except when necessary. Put distracting thoughts out of your mind and tell yourself, I will think about that later. Third, maintaining a look and an act of confidence and proactivity on the court will not give your opponent reason to think that they can be more brave and that you will fold. Bjorn Borg said that although he was incredibly nervous, he learned to eliminate showing any kind of nerves on the outside. Being confident does not necessarily, though, mean being completely emotionless. Fourth, if you are learning and making mental notes in regard to the match and you begin to discover then more quickly what are the relative strengths and weaknesses of your opponent, Bill Tilden's classic advice from 1925, find your opponent's favorite shot and never give it to them. And conversely, find out what they don't like and use that when you need it. The effects of momentum for that can be obvious. Even if you should lose, those notes that you keep in your mind and write down, hopefully later, are going to help you against that player or similar opponents in the future. So protect your momentum with those four items. Now, if any of this strikes a chord with you, go to your pro and ask them for help on this. Tennis is not a remote learning sport. Right? All of this is just food for thought for you to become a better player and go to someone and get some more help. All right, so we're going to have a commercial here. And when we get back, we're going to bring in our guest, Dan McCain. And I'm very excited to get him on the show here. All right, very good.
Alternative Lighting and Power is a renewable energy solutions-focused company with an emphasis in helping athletic facilities. We would like to upgrade your tennis complex to the 21st century. We offer a range of services that will upgrade your tennis complex. We can use our technology to make your facility virtually disappear from the energy grid. We can provide lights, scoreboards, scoring systems, cooling systems, heating systems, camera systems, covered seating areas, wastewater management, and even new buildings. Our company is located in Houston, Texas, but we provide services to all 50 states and internationally. We would love to visit with you about our opportunities. Please contact Ed Love at 832-549-4193 or email at elove@alternativel-p.com. You can also visit our website at www.alternativel-p.com. We are the sunny side of business.
All right, that's great. And then have you all noticed that energy is not getting less expensive these days? So anyway, Dan, hello there. Are you there?
I'm here. How
excellent.
We doing?
Welcome to the show. How are you doing today?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me, Bill. I appreciate the opportunity.
Yeah, that's great. No, I'm excited to have you on, and I remember that we met very briefly during your time here in NorCal, and I wish I had an opportunity to get to know you better then. But tell us what are you currently up to right now? What's your current thing coming up for the summer here?
Comes as a great relief to finally have finished this book project. Working on this book, Momentum on the ATP Tour, has been a project of mine over the last year and a half, and just very proud to finally have it off my shoulders and on the presses. And I'm the head pro out here in Virginia Beach, Virginia, at a club called the Cavalier Golf and Yacht Club, and certainly very fortunate to have this gig. And really just kind of, my wife and I bought a new house, and so we're just getting settled with our little puppy Charleston into the new place. So things are going really well here.
Excellent. So tell us a little bit about the book. What's, if people aren't familiar with it, what are some of the highlights to that would attract people to it?
Well, the book was released about, a few weeks ago. And it's, like I said, it's called Momentum on the ATP Tour. So it focuses on men's professional tennis, obviously. And, the more that I delved into the concept of momentum, originally I had been doing a lot of research on the biomechanics aspect of movement and basic human movement on the tennis court. And I came across a fascinating model that was developed by the LTA, which is the Lawn Tennis Association. For those who don't know, it's sort of like the USTA or the Tennis Australia for the UK. And decades ago, they developed a model called the Biomech model. Biomech being an acronym for the term biomechanics, B standing for balance, I standing for inertia, O for opposite forces, M for momentum, and E for elastic energy, and C for the coordination chain. And these concepts, what I felt like central to operating in a technically sound fashion on the court. And I began to do more and more research within this and felt like these were the undercurrent of technique within each stroke. And one of the main concepts within that.
Let me follow up with something here. Yeah, that's great. And so would you say that these things, these factors that come together, it's kind of like the interconnectedness of everything, that you get kind of a comprehensive understanding of all the factors of movement that come together?
That's exactly right. And really all of the chapters in the volume 2, which focuses on the biomechanics, in my view, central around the concept of momentum. There's a term in biomechanics. Anyone taking any kind of basic biomechanics 101 course in college would understand the notion of linear momentum, which basically means that things are traveling in one direction. And I felt strongly that the more research I did on the concept was that it was very it served as a tangible metaphor for how things can go as far as performance and outcome and psychologically. And this led me to a lot of interesting research on a widely termed notion among psychologists called psychological momentum. Mm-hmm. And like you said, the notion of momentum is in this book serves as a unifying theme of not just physical human movement out there on the court, but also standard modes of operation in an ideal sense, or perhaps unideal, depending on how things are going. You know.
Yeah, that's interesting. You know, it calls to mind. I'm not sure if this was a talk or a book from Jim Lehrer, but he was talking about the different psychological capacities, you know, that not only do we have strength in our bodies, but we have similar types of strength in our mind, of resistive strength and flexibility and all these things that, you know, sometimes being able to be emotionally flexible allows you to absorb some momentum that might be coming your way.
That's exactly right. And Jim Lehrer.
Form of attack. I think it's very interesting that you put the two together in the same book. And before I looked at your book, I was a little skeptical. How's this going to work? You know, he's putting a psychological thing together with a physical thing that seemed to be not connected. And then as I looked through that, I saw, no, this really is amazing how connected all of that is.
That's exactly the intention of the book. And certainly I think any player can attest to having hot and cold streaks within their matches. And then it begs the question, one that Jim Lehrer, like you mentioned, has certainly delved into, is what causes these hot and cold streaks? And, you know, if you open that discussion to all levels of tennis and within both genders, I felt that that could go in about 1,000 different directions, which is why I chose to focus within one particular aspect in tennis is just men's professional tennis, because, you know, obviously men and women are very, very different creatures, and there are going to be a lot of different causes for peak performance for women and men.
Yeah, that's a great point. I know we talked about this earlier. I think what I'm going to do, I'd like to make a comment on that, and then we're going to run a commercial, and we'll come back and kind of flesh that out. But I felt very blessed to have been subject to a talk by Dr. Cheryl McLaughlin, who did the brain scans of men and women engaged in various activities. So she scientifically proved multitasking in women and left parietal lobe focus in men. And it really changed my coaching career. It really helped me coach female athletes much better. But anyway, we're going to go to a commercial, and we're going to come back with Dan. We're going to go a little deeper because, I'm pretty happy with all how this all is going. So here we go. See you on the other side. Okay, well, I pushed the button for the commercial there. And I don't hear it. Dan, are you there still?
Absolutely.
Okay.
I'm here.
So I'll tell you what. I pushed the button for the commercial. It's not happening. And so I'll tell you what. Let's just continue. And if it all of a sudden pops on, then we'll stop. And I might try it again, and I'm up here. Let me actually try this. I'm going to try it one more time. See what happens.
Okay.
And I think we've got some kind of malfunction here. Okay, so I'll try that again in a little bit. All right. So tell me a little bit about your influences as a coach. Who were your influences that helped you to get where you're at and kind of gave you your underpinnings?
Well, I'm the son of Dave McCain, who is a former director of tennis at Saddlebrook Tennis Academy. And my father had a great deal of success in the coaching world. He was a college coach and coached a number of pros on both WTA and the ATP tours, including my sister Kelly, who played in all of the Grand Slams multiple times. I was blessed to live in that household growing up, and my dad always said if I ever wanted to coach, he all of the good coaches that he knew had mentored under other good coaches. And so certainly I don't claim to know as much as my father, but I certainly was blessed to be around that environment and learn from him and his experiences. And in my younger 20s, after I finished graduate school, I went to work for the Higueras Gorin Tennis Academy. Higueras meaning Jose Higueras, who has coached Sampras and Federer and Capriati and Bergera and Chang and Todd Martin, and the list goes on. And right. Gorin stands for Vitaly Gorin, who's been a successful ATP Tour coach for a number of players, including Dmitry Tursunov, who's been in the top 20 in the world, and Vitaly's also been one of the Davis Cup coaches for Russia. And I consider those three men tremendous influences. And finally, I would say that my number one influence in coaching has been working with Lee Hurst of 360 Tennis. Lee is now living in New York, working with Tim Mayotte, with a bunch of high-performance juniors. So having worked with those men and having them sort of show me the ropes of coaching and on many levels, I feel like I gained a lot of positive experiences from them and certainly try to apply their concepts as much as I can working with the kids that I work with and the people that I try to help.
So, it's funny. I had a kid that was playing juniors around the time that Dmitry was just killing everybody here in NorCal. And, we used to talk about what would it take to beat him? And my player just said, "Coach, come on, not possible." Because Dmitry at that time was a man among boys. And I think he was serving probably 130, maybe more, and everybody was extremely afraid of him. So he definitely was definitely standing well inside everybody's cerebral cortex right at the beginning of the match. So yeah, so you know, you can tell when somebody's got the talent to really make it big, because they're going to dominate the area that they're in, without a doubt.
Yes. Yeah.
Striking.
Yeah,
okay,
absolutely.
So if from all of those influences, what would you say is one big concept that comes from that? I mean, what's the one major thing that you learned from those influences that you carry forward?
Well, you know, you kind of learn quite a bit from, you know, everybody has their own strengths and weaknesses. And my dad was excellent at building the fundamentals with the strokes, but I think he really excelled at helping his players understand strategy, not just your own choices on your side of the court that'll work against everyone, but also sort of identifying and exploiting weaknesses, which was I would consider one of my biggest strengths as a player, you know, as in juniors and trying to go all the way up towards the top of the national rankings and playing ITFs and, you know, trying to crack the top 100 and doing all that stuff. And even at Michigan when I was playing in college, I think that was still, you know, one of the things that helped me win matches, was just understanding how to make your opponent have the worst day possible as far as their performance level. And, you know, being around Vitaly Goran was a blessing on many levels. He taught me what it means to be a man on many levels. And, you know, as a guy in my young 20s, that's important to be around that kind of leadership. But Vitaly is known for being a genius in technique and teaching technique. And you think you know a lot about technique until you meet Vitaly.
Wow.
And I think, you know, Jose's strength as a coach, you know, being one of the greatest clay court players of his time, I think he was reached as high as 5 in the world, and he almost helped Sampras, you know, win the French that year. He certainly came close the year he coached Sampras, and, you know, he coached Chang win the French. Obviously, his time with Bergera was dominant, and, you know, he became known as a coach after he took Courier from a lifelong 30 in the world player to an overwhelmingly dominant number one. But his strengths as a coach were teaching choices and decision-making and work ethic off the tournament court and on the practice court and with fitness and being a smart player as far as being a high-percentage player. And he was excellent, to say the least, at that. He's head of coaching at the USTA right now, and I have no doubt that he's helping, you know, everyone that is around him, to say the very least. But, you know, I think that stuff had such a major effect on my understanding of how to help players develop. But I think it pales in comparison to what I learned from Lee Hurst at 360 Tennis. And Lee's – I learned how to teach movement with Lee. And I began to consider movement just as much as technique as any portion of the forehand ground stroke, like the loop and the follow through and shoulder rotation and loading and so on and so forth.
Yeah,
I began to understand the most efficient possible movement was just as effective as doing wind sprints, if not more so. I would say much more so as effective as doing fitness training. So it was a great education that I was fortunate to have, and I'm certainly feel very blessed to be able to share some of that in the book Momentum.
That's great. You know, it's funny, you're spurring me on to one of my crackpot theories. So let me throw something at you out of left field, all right?
Okay.
I believe Djokovic's coaches have made an attempt to kind of sell a proprietary coaching technique. And if you look at the evolution of his game, I believe it centers around having him move in nearly 360 degrees. So, like, let's say they have him move 120 degrees backwards and measure his ball speed and fit, and have, and they work on any specific strand of movement outward from the center until they find a place where the ball speed diminishes, and then they work on that angle.
Well, certainly, you know, Djokovic's lateral movement and diagonal movements, whether it be forward or backward, and even forward, just straight up forward or backward movement, is second to none, to say the least. It also helps when you're 6'2 or 6'3 and you have a body of rock star and you can, you know, do pretty much anything you want, anytime you want, because you're such an off-the-charts athlete. That certainly doesn't hurt. But I would say that Djokovic right now is much more fundamentally sound than he was, say, 6 or 8 years ago. You know, one thing that people forget is that, you know, this year at the French and certainly last year at the finals of the Australian, when he had those marathon matches with Nadal, he was still serving at 128, 130 miles an hour deep into the fifth set. And so, you know, I think his fitness and endurance level is a fairly big deal. But I think his movement efficiency certainly makes a huge difference. He expends less energy and gets to the ball faster than the average player, to say the least. And he gets more out of it. And, you know, that's one of the things we really dig deep into is movement patterns and movement techniques that really mimic track sprinters. So they get the most out of, you know, their explosive movement, particularly to start the race. I would also say that, you know, Djokovic made a concerted effort to seek out different coaches to help him with his serve technique, and I still say that's one of the biggest moves of his career. So once he could hold serve with, like everybody else, you know, some say he may have the greatest return of serve of all time. I'm not going to argue with that. So once his serve really jumped up and into the same level of his contemporaries in the top 5 and 10 in the world, I think his whole entire confidence changed.
That's great. So those are some key insights. Thank you. And so now, so tell us a little bit about your coaching career in college. Where did you coach?
I coached at Illinois State, and then again at Cal State. There were mid-major Division I programs that you know, we're incredibly rewarding. I mean, being a college coach is a great gig. It's exciting all the time. And, you know, the recruiting process is one that requires a range of skills to, you know, be able to persuade and show off the things that you have and persuade parents and kids that, you know, your program is and your university is you know, a worthwhile enterprise and can help their lives and advance their careers, not just offer them a good tennis program. And certainly, you know, it's a challenge. You know, the habits that an 18, 19-year-old has is far more ingrained, whether it be good or bad, than one, say, of a 10, 11, 12-year-old. And I consider my job very easy right now because I get to work with kids.
Dan, you need to interject here. Sorry to cut you off, Dan, but we have about 45 seconds left here in the live portion of the show. So why don't you give us a little contact information, and then people can find out if they're interested in your book, then they can contact you directly and you can take it from there. So how can people reach you?
Well, my email address is DanMcCain.com or DanMcCain@AOL.com. I have a website. Like I just said, it's DanMcCain.com. You can find information about contacting me or learning about the books that I've written. This is the third book Momentum is the third book, and it can be purchased in three different ways. You can buy Volume 1 and 2 together, or you can buy Volume 1 or Volume 2 separately. So those can be found on Amazon, and information can be found not just on Amazon, but also on my website, danmckinney.com.
Okay, great. Thank you. And so the live portion has now ended. So anybody who was listening to us live is not hearing us currently, but the rest of it goes on a podcast, and probably about 85-90% of the people that listen to these things listen to them later. So,
okay.
So thank you for that. And now, when it comes to, if we're talking about kind of the 3-0, 3-5, 4-0 player, what are some of the fundamental principles of playing tennis that those people miss? What are some things that you see going wrong?
The number one, I think any player will tell you, the number one aspect of winning and losing matches is unforced errors. And I think, the better you get as a player, the more you lose sight of, hitting the ball in the court more times than your opponent is how you win a tennis point. And as basic and simple as that sounds, with the racket and string technology providing more power than ever and more spin than ever, I think in conjunction with, the sports center highlight culture that we live in now, I think a lot of players are constantly trying to hit this most spectacular shot to win points instead of playing high percentage tennis. And the best advice that I give players is hit it in as your top priority, as ridiculous as it sounds. And then the more that you can play keep away with and move your opponent around within the point, just by sticking to these two basic strategies, it could kind of help you hopefully gain momentum in your matches or help you dig yourself out of a rut.
Yeah, that's great. I have to tell you a little story. I took over a high school tennis team that had lost meekly in the first round of North Coast Section. And I've got these kids, and it's a team full of ranked juniors in NorCal. And I'm thinking, why can't they win in North Coast Section? So I'm looking at how they play, and they're hitting down the line too early in rallies. They're hitting cross-court approach shots. And so every match we started with, remember, guys, rally cross-court and build your point cross-court and get your first serve in. And then...
Yeah.
Was that very first year we took out the number one seeds in North Coast Section, and then the next year we beat the 2 and 1 seeds in the same day in 97 degree heat by hitting the ball cross court. Kind of amazing, huh?
Yeah, well, I think it's just a matter of being, having a mentality of playing consistent tennis, regardless of the style of play, whether or not an all-court player or an aggressive baseliner or even a counterpuncher. I think the notion of playing consistent tennis first is one of the fundamentals that, that even advanced players can lose sight of from time to time. And, I think removing double faults from your game and making every return a serve from your game, I think there's basic things that you can always look to do regardless of your level to just sort of get yourself on track or maybe get back on track.
Yeah, that's interesting. I try to avoid the use of the word consistent because I never hear anyone say that they're ever satisfied with how consistent they are. Uses the word consistent, it's always to beat themselves up, I need to be more consistent. So I try to avoid that. But, yeah, I get the concept. I try to steer them onto, how about some calculated risks? I mean, every shot's a risk. And so sometimes
I hear that a lot from the commentators. talking about taking risks and the need to take risks. And I certainly never looked at it that way. I don't think, you know, a smart player really ever takes risks. And the reason I say that is because, you know, when there are three kinds of situations within a baseline rally, you're either in trouble with a high degree of difficulty and you're just flat out on defense. And I think any smart player would tell you that when you're on defense, you're going to slow the ball down, hit your shot with a much higher trajectory and with less pace, and try to neutralize the rally by giving yourself time to recover and hopefully hitting it high enough and deep enough to, you know, get yourself out of trouble. And, you know, I think it's pretty easy for players to attack short balls and be aggressive when you get an easy shot that is landing short in the court that you can move up in and increase the pace on. And I think those two areas are very obvious to players once you kind of just ask them about it. But I think it's the neutral ball, the neutral situation where the rallies are 50-50 and no one has really gained an advantage in the rally. I think that's where matches are won and lost most of the time. So, for example, if you know, you ask somebody that's a pretty good player, say, on a scale of 1 to 10, if 10 is as hard as you could possibly hit it, how hard would you hit a neutral ball where you're in a neutral situation, where the shot degree of difficulty is not that difficult, it's not that tough, but it's also not easy. You know, I think most people that I ask sort of come in between the 7 and 8 zone. And so I think, you know, with every neutral situation, if you don't go for winners and you don't just push it in, a lot of players feel like they're doing something with the shot, with that three-quarter pace shot. So it satisfies that need to be aggressive and try to control the rallies, but it's also a safe enough shot. They don't go to the line. It's also a safe enough shot where, you know, it's going to be easy to make most of those, even to the point where it's surprising if you would miss it. And by sticking to the situation within baseline rallies, you know, if you're in a neutral situation, you hit a neutral shot, or you just try to set yourself up, maybe create a short ball so you can attack. And if you're on defense, don't go for a winner. Don't even try to set up an easy ball, a short ball. Just get it back in play. Try to neutralize the rally. And I think by sticking to the situations regularly, you know, players can easily be consistent because they're going for shots they know they can make. And I think even on the even in pro tennis, even in men's professional tennis, certainly widespread in women's tennis, most of the errors that come are from making choices within their shots that don't stick to the situation at hand. So I feel like Sharapova at the French played a really great match, but I thought there were a lot of neutral situations where she went for winners. And
Stacey, I think you really answered that question really well, and I'd like to move on to another one.
Yeah. Sure.
So we've got a couple minutes left here, and I have a couple more questions. So let's. I like the depth of your answers quite a bit, but let's try to rattle off a few before we get done here.
You got
so
it.
So What quick advice would you give to parents and players as they navigate the competitive zone of junior tennis?
Well, you know, I think number one, you've got to play a lot of practice matches. There's a ton of academy kids that hit the ball fantastic, don't play practice matches, and then get to their tournaments and can't win. And, you know, you got to play a lot of matches in practice. You also got to play a lot of tournaments. And I think the best advice I would give for parents is to have their kids play three types of tournaments. Have them play tournaments where they're playing up a level, where they get challenged and they see what they need to do to get better. And then the next type of tournament is have them play something where they have a chance to win the whole thing, but they're going to have to play their best to do so.
Yeah.
And then I think the last kind of tournament is missed out the most. I think it's very important to play tournaments where you're expected to win. You play under pressure. You play matches where you – tournaments where you have a chance to rack up a lot of wins. And one of the things that Paul Goldstein, who was in the top 50 in the world, said in my book, He said, go play, go win a lot of matches. And he said, go beat your grandmother if you have to in a tournament. It doesn't matter. Just win a lot of matches. And I thought that was a funny way of describing that idea.
Well, nothing succeeds like success. I'm a big fan of the threshold of about 75% win percentage, because if you're winning 100% of your matches, then you're not getting challenged. And, you know, you've got to have some losses, because that's where you're going to get your challenge from. Okay, so thank you for that. And then, now, when it comes to, what are your thoughts on the 10 and under mandate with the transition balls and all that? Do you have something on that?
Yeah, that was one of the things I worked with a lot during my time in player development for the USTA. And I think that, overall, it's a very good thing. It makes it easier for kids to play. It makes them easier to be successful. Kids that are advanced, that are nine, that play really well, can play with the green dot ball. They can have much far better points and execute their strokes far easier with better mechanics and have longer rallies than they could the yellow ball. And the orange ball makes it, it's the same argument for with the shorter 60-foot court. And with the red ball and the 36-foot court, it's remarkable how well these kids can play right off the bat. And they get to play matches instead of just go do drills. And they get to have fun and compete right off the bat. So it makes it more fun for the kids to play, which makes it more likely they're going to stick to tennis. The argument against it is for the top 1%. And that is not a good argument, because if they're that good, they can go play 12s. And the using the yellow ball for an 8-year-old is sort of like you and I trying to play tennis with a medicine ball. It's that heavy to them, just like a medicine ball would be that heavy to us. So it'd be really difficult for us to be able to, execute a good swing path and have a really interesting long rally within the point.
Well, one of my problems with the whole thing is the wild inconsistency of the product, because I can think of three different brands of red ball that bounce so incredibly differently that there's absolutely no consistency to how the match would be played. Some people would counter, well, all tennis balls are different, and I say yes to that, but in a very narrow range of acceptability. So I've encountered red balls that just plain don't bounce, and red balls that if it's 80 degrees, then the ball's going to bounce over kids' heads and fly like crazy. And
yeah,
same with orange balls. I haven't had the same experience with the green balls. I think the green balls might be the most consistent. But, to sanction something and force kids to play something where they might actually have a horrible experience because of the inconsistency in the equipment, I think that's a problem.
I think if you're going to play an orange ball, you're going to have inconsistency with the environment from tournament to tournament. Courts are going to be faster. Courts are going to be slower. It's going to be windy one day. It's going to be cloudy another day, and sunny and hot another day. And I think part of that is, learning to deal with adversity right off the bat and just kind of suck it up and play is part of that. But I think anytime you're talking about making it easier for the kids to play and be successful, I think that's a positive thing. And, when you talk about the intricacies within how things are being run, I think that's a fair argument. But overall, the kids can play, a green tournament if they want, at least where I am here in Virginia. They can play an orange tournament if they want. They can play a red tournament if they want, at least within the age. So the kids can pick and choose, with whichever tournaments they think is best for them. But certainly, I think we're in a transition generation a little bit, that a lot of people aren't used to it, and a lot of people are getting used to it. So I think it's important for the coaches to work with the kids and the parents and educate them about, you know, what might be best for them and, you know, what arena, what court, what ball, and so on.
Yeah, yeah. So, all right, well, hey, thanks so much for coming on the show. And, you know, everybody's got your contact information, so I hope that they will inquire about your book. I know that it can be found on Amazon, so if you search for Momentum on the ATP Tour, then you're going to find it. And I took a look at it. I would say that, you know, I read it and scanned part of it, and I was very impressed and thought it's a very helpful guide and a unique perspective. So thanks for coming on the show. Maybe we can do this again sometime.
Yeah, I really appreciate it, Bill. I know you're doing great work out there, so I really appreciate the opportunity.
Terrific. Take care and have a great Saturday.
All right, you too, Bill. Thanks.
Bye. All right, bye-bye. All right, so thanks to Dan for coming on the show. You know, what great answers there to all those questions. I didn't even get to ask all my questions, but I got a lot more there than I expected. All right, so thank you to all of you who've gone back and listened to past episodes. I see that that's happening, and I appreciate that. I want to thank Saul Schwartz, my new Facebook friend, for teasing me about the tennis troops thing. So that's the last mention of the tennis troops. Haha. Anyway. Also, I need to tease you, the audience. I would like to thank you for sending absolutely zero tweets or emails to me. Thank you very much. Next week, I hope to thank you for sending something. So next week, we're going to have Vic Braden on the show. And Vic is one of the greatest coaches in the history of the game. If anyone says the game has passed Vic by, I would counter and say he is doing as much research now as ever before, and he's probably more at the cutting edge than any other person of his generation, for sure. And many people who are much younger, all right? So Vic also does some incredible things that keep our country safe, and that's an interesting thing. We'll get into that a little bit. But so please share this link to this show with your tennis friends and players and your audience and all that. Really appreciate that. We're going to have some great stuff coming up. So we've got Vic Braden coming up. We're going to have Dr. Martin Baroque from Czech Republic, who coaches in Switzerland now. He'll be coming up soon. Also, we're going to have Steve Chandler, who is one of my favorite life coaches and is going to have some great advice for coaches and parents and players in terms of how to succeed. I can't wait for that. So, thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week. So I'm running the disclaimer here.
Opinions stated by various contributors to the UR Tennis Network and its programming are not to be considered as endorsed by the UR Tennis Network. Participants are encouraged to use their own discernments and draw their own conclusions. All information, products, and services offered by the UR Tennis Network are for personal use only. The UR Tennis Network does not confirm nor deny the validity or accuracy of information contained within the network. Any products or services provided for should be used solely for entertainment purposes. We emphasize the idea of keeping an open mind and not construing the products, services, or data as factual. This is Jason Haynes, CEO of the UR Tennis Network. We are proud to announce the 2013 summer camp season has begun. At ussportcamps.com, you can plan out a Nike tennis camp experience. These are offered to both adults and juniors for day and overnight camps. Visit ussportcamps.com to pick up a brochure and join over 50,000 youth who say yes to our summer camp experience. Join a Nike tennis camp at www.ussportcamps.com or call us at 1-800-NIKE-CAMPS. In 2013, let our summer camps be your victory. Choose the Nike Tennis Camps and take your game to the next level.